Our sermon this morning is going to be a sermon in three parts. So you might have noticed in your order of service, reflection one, reflection two, for reflection three. Don't get too comfortable. Somewhere around 60 or 63 of the Common Era, which used to be known as AD, right? A letter was written, as best can be figured, to Jewish Christians who were experiencing persecution among the Romans. If the calendar serves us correctly, Jesus would have been crucified around 32 or 33, perhaps, and this fledgling community of Jesus' followers, who were largely but not entirely Jewish, and a mere generation or two ahead of his dying, would have been struggling to figure out what his life and death meant to them and what the rules for engagement were with this new prophet's calling. The letter was entitled, the letter that was written was entitled to the Hebrews and is more commonly called just Hebrews, and it is a book in the New Testament following the Gospels. Now, it's helpful to remember that there was no authority determining who could belong or how. Was it required to be Jewish in order to follow the teachings of Jesus? Were the dietary laws important? Did one need to be circumcised? This letter to the Hebrews encourages its readers to understand that the prophets who have come before them, including all the big prophets, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Rahab, Gideon, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, all those prophets acted by faith. By faith, this prophet did this. By faith, this prophet did that, it says. There's a whole chapter that outlines what each of them did, and each sentence starts, by faith. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 13 through 16. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who seek thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly country. So this morning, we're going to skip over some of the details of their respective adventures, many of which may be known to you. Noah, of course, his ark, Abraham being the first monotheist, Sarah having a baby at 99. We're going to skip. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's totally true. Well, it says it. So we're going to jump over a few of those details to chapter 12 in the letter of Hebrews. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. It's the first time we see this term. It reminds us, and we are reminded this morning of where it comes from. I was at an interview a few years back where I was invited to bring with me something of importance, of my choosing. I could bring whatever I wanted. I took a bracelet that had been gifted to me by a very dear friend who had died not so very long ago of pancreatic cancer. And I took a rock from another dear friend who had died suddenly and tragically in a bicycle accident. I wanted them to be with me in spirit, at least. They had been close and supportive friends of mine, and I wanted them to be present for this period of time. After explaining my reasoning, one of the participants on the panel said, "Yes, we all bring our cloud of witnesses." And I was startled and I was unsettled. It took me a while to recognize that these two people weren't in my cloud yet. They were still very much with me. They had not been long gone from this earth and were not yet, for me at least, among the cloud company. I don't know exactly when that transition happens, when those who have been a part of something we care deeply about are no longer among us. I'm not sure when they rise into the category of cloud witness. My friends had not yet left my side. But for us here, the population of that cloud of witnesses is filled with those who, by faith, built this church over the last 300 years. It's important to remember them, and some of them may not yet be for you in a cloud. It's important to remember them even when we don't know all their names or their stories, because by faith they built a church home, knowing its importance in their lives and trusting in its importance for ours. There are so many of them. Walk around, you'll find the plaques. Aside from the countless parishioners, there were 28 ministers, I think. So one question becomes, how did we come to be known as Theodore Parker Church? I'm going to invite Julie McFay to come up and share some of those thoughts with us.
This congregation in 1712 was named the Second Parish Church of Roxbury. In 1837, Theodore Parker was called to be its minister. Charles McIntosh remembered him this way. He came here a plain, unpretentious young man who at once entered into all the interests of his people. Again, he says, when Mr. Parker resigned his Roxbury pastorate, the people felt they could not part with him, nor he with them. In 1841, while he was still a minister here, Theodore gave an ordination sermon called The Transient and Permanent in Christianity. He had given the same sermon in West Roxbury, causing no great consternation to his congregation made up of farmers and mechanics, so-called. This sermon said that Christianity is true in the same way that geometry is true, not requiring the Bible or the miracles of Jesus to prove it. There was such a hue and cry from the more orthodox in Boston that even ministers who agreed with him shunned him. He was devastated. He had always been a scholar whose ideas had received approval from his peers and those he held in high esteem. Now he felt alone, isolated, and worse, castigated for his true belief. The Boston Association of Congregational Ministers, his peers, asked him to resign. But he refused, saying he claimed freedom of the pulpit. Nevertheless, he was very hurt. The controversy had received wide coverage through the Boston newspapers, and he received piles of hate mail here in the West Roxbury post office. His parishioners gathered around to defend him, one going so far as to send him to Europe on a year-long sabbatical for relief and healing. I believe that West Roxbury's steadfastness to him when he was so terribly low is a high point in our congregation's long history. Many ministers who took difficult stands in the pulpit did not find such support from their congregations. From Theodore Parker's time through the 1900s, our meeting house was called Parker's Church because the entire community held him in high regard. In 1962, when Roslindale Unitarian Church and the then named First Church of West Roxbury joined, naming the church Theodore Parker Church was a logical choice. Through the years, living with his image before us literally, we are reminded of his love of justice and willingness to put himself on the line to support it. It keeps me grounded in what it means to be a community which, with love, supports justice and mercy.
I should have known that Michael Servetus would not be an unknown entity in this congregation. In our chalice lighting this morning, however, we referenced how Robin introduced him, Spanish theologian and physician. He was, what is the expression, the Renaissance man, like during the Renaissance, I don't know. Maybe that's where it came from. Don't know. Michael Servetus, who surely sits in every Unitarian Universalist cloud of witness, whether we're aware of it or not. What got him in trouble, what ended up getting him burned at the stake, as John referred to, in Geneva, in Switzerland, by John Calvin's Protestant Council on October 27th, 1553, was voicing the truth as he saw it, calling into question nearly 1,200 years of Catholic doctrine. He wrote a book called On the Errors of the Trinity. Widespread aversion to Servetus's death has been taken as signaling the birth in Europe of the idea of religious tolerance, a principle now more important to modern Unitarian Universalists than anti-Trinitarianism. Spanish scholar on Servetus's work, Angel Alcala, identified the radical search for truth and the right for freedom of conscience as Servetus's main legacies, rather than his theology. The Polish-American scholar Marian Hiller has studied the evolution of freedom of conscience from Servetus and the Polish Socinians to John Locke to Thomas Jefferson and the American Declaration of Independence. According to Hiller, historically speaking, Servetus died so that freedom of conscience could become a civil right in modern society. That is quite a legacy, undoubtedly influencing Theodore Parker's thinking as well, stretching the thread of contemporary liberal religious life back in time and encouraging us to pull it forward figuratively and literally, as our West Roxbury ancestors did. So the effort today is to tie us back to those who are in the clouds way before us, to those who may be somewhat more recently and forward. It seemed a good effort at this time of year, coincident with Samhain and with All Saints. So I want to read something to you from that was received in March of 1931. Here at the Theodore Parker Church, a letter was received from B. Bunker, who was the assistant trust officer, to carry out the wishes of our sister, Mrs. Sophia E. Lee of Salem, Massachusetts. We are sending you herewith her gift of a $1,000 bond to be held by you in memory of our father, Reverend Edmund B. Wilson, who was pastor of the First Unitarian Church in West Roxbury from 1852 to 1859. And the income only to be used by you. Her gift, her legacy, on behalf of her father. The undersigned is informed by Mr. Lee's secretary that this bond represents a voluntary gift from the Mrs. Wilson, paid out of the residue of their sister's estate, which was given to them outright under the terms of her will. It accordingly appears there are no other strings attached to the gift than appears in the letter. If you require further information, we shall do our best to furnish it. A more tangible thread, perhaps, coming forward in time. I want to pause in our historical reverie for our morning offering. But I want to let you know a little bit about why we chose it. The psalm that you'll hear this morning is the Bobby McFerrin arrangement of the 23rd Psalm. Michael and I talked about offering it today in honor of the solace that this psalm historically has provided to those who have lost loved ones. It is a psalm about peace, about protection, about company in times of darkness and need. I know that for many of us as Unitarian Universalists, we struggle with words like Lord, the house of the Lord, being anointed with oil, perhaps, or glory be to God. But I encourage you to try to hear these words expansively this morning and to appreciate McFerrin's nod to the feminine divine. Like our stories this morning, it celebrates tradition with a nod to the contemporary. Let there be an offering to sustain and strengthen this place, which is sacred to so many of us, a community of memory and hope, for we are now the keepers of the dream. So in the text of the West Roxbury Magazine, which was published in 1900 by a committee for the First Parish West Roxbury, is a long description of the gathering members. It's sort of fun to hear a little bit about who we have been. Plain folk in homespun clothes. This is describing the gatherers from 1712, made trim and neat in honor of the Sabbath day. And of the gathering place they built for worship, it was said it was built with sound of laughter and good cheer, rude enough, built of rough-hewn logs, but it was their own liberty, and God was there. Not a vestige of it remains, the writing says, save only a grave or two in the old cemetery that marks the spot. The meeting house is gone. The purpose that built it lives. As I've been reading through old accounts of this congregation's life, it occurred to me that we don't really know these people. We don't know the nuances of their individual lives, whether they were happy or troubled, whether they were secretly passionate about something or simply marking their time. We do have some profiles, courtesy of a set of personal recollections, with the bias of its author, Charles McIntosh, I imagine. So he writes about a Reverend T.B. Forbush, who was installed here in July 1863, serving only until May of 1868. It's a rather whimsical one. I thought you might enjoy it. He was not a man who took the deep interest in his parish work that his predecessors did. He was quite a fluent speaker, wordy in prayer, but not the same deep, loving words that the parish people had been used to. He seemed to be fond of the comfortable side of life. Who can blame him? It was quite a tiresome effort for him to perform one service on Sunday. He used to say it took him until the middle of the following week to recover from the effort. When the time came for him to leave, it was not hard for him and the parish to separate. We hope that was a one-time thing, right? We know to a large extent that all who have come before us have been challenged by the same things we are. In a report of the Standing Committee in April of 1913, 100 years ago, the secretary mentions a successful 200th anniversary celebration. That might sound familiar to some of you, having just celebrated your 300th. They are pleased to report very little debt, offset by a balance of $194. They therefore feel very optimistic about the future. But by that, they do not wish to conduce a false and indolent optimism. What the society especially needs, the report maintains, is an increased membership. Some things never change. By 1924, the parish was in debt again, owing $1,900, working diligently for 3 years to reduce that debt. They were obliged to report that no money had been available for repairs, except such as were absolutely necessary. Consequently, the buildings were in poor condition. The tower leaked so that the plaster was falling off. The heating apparatus was completely worn out, and various leaks had developed in the roof. The cornerstone says 1900, and I wondered, how did all that happen within 24 years? We can be comforted by the rest of the report from that year that indicates that by 1927, the mortgage was paid, a heating plant had been installed, the roofs had been recovered where necessary, electric light had been installed in the church and the parish house, and new insurance had been placed on both buildings. They were workers, just as you all have been. I discovered recently a short piece in a literary magazine called Sun the other day. It was called The Unbreakable Thread. It was written by David James Duncan, who is author of The River Wye, if that's familiar to any of you. He describes the reality of what he calls moaning in our lives, the fundamental expression of discontent or dis-ease with various challenges, perhaps the incessant demands of physical space or loss or. But he says moaning is connected with hope. With whatever challenges our forebears faced, our cloud of witnesses hoped to. They hoped to make a difference, I think. They hoped to be sustained in religious community. And we are connected by the unbreakable thread of that intention. Annie Dillard reminds us that the opposite of faith is not doubt, but certainty. Our letter to the Hebrews pulls us by that unbreakable thread to those who lived by faith, not certainty, by faith. Noah, Abraham, Moses, Joseph, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, connected to religious longing of the free faith of Servetus as well, who died representing open inquiry. The thread connecting us to our first gathering with the Reverend Ebenezer Thayer in a rough-hewn, hand-built meeting house. It connects us by thread through the building of multiple others and into the walls that hold us here. A thread connects our longing for wholeness, for love, for the search for something closer to heaven right here on earth in the company of seekers. Of those in the cloud, do they haunt us? I don't think so. I think instead they inspire us, and they keep us company in our shared and ongoing endeavor, in a faith that is not certainty, but journey on a wide and open road. They came here as we do for community, to nourish our souls, to care for each other, to build a better world together. Our closing hymn will be an invitation to just that, for comfort, for song, for company, for dance, the heartbeat of this place for many, many years. May we be for others what our cloud of witnesses have been for us.